Bienvenidas. I am your host to Courageous Mujer Podcast. My name is Gladys Godinez, and I am here to support, embrace, and celebrate Latinas in the heartland. It is time to share our stories, break some barriers, and glass ceilings while we're at it. Like the song says, let's get loud.
Hello, bienvenida, Yolanda. I am so excited that you're here with Courageous Mujer Podcast. Thank you so much for agreeing to be here with me. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Gladys. I'm really excited to be here with you, too. I'm kind of nervous, but I'm looking forward to doing this. And thank you again for inviting me.
Well, thank you. And don't worry, I'm a little nervous, too. Tengo un poquito de sweat on my nose, so we're okay. We'll figure it out as we go along. And I'm very grateful that you're here. As you know, you have been a big inspiration in my life. You have done so much in the state of Nebraska. Just the things that I have seen may just cover this whole hour, if not more, but you have received various awards and you have led so many awesome movements here in the state that I'm so happy to introduce you to those that may not know you, but I'm also excited for those that may not know some of those personal stories to start hearing them from you. So let's get to know Yolanda Nuncio, an icon and a legacy in my mind, in regards to the Latino Chicano movement in the state of Nebraska. And I want to start a little bit with what is something exciting that's happening in your life right now, something that you're looking forward to.
Well, at this very moment, we're getting ready to go on a short vacation. And my husband and I, we're going to Cancun on Friday, and it's the first time that we've been out of town in over a year. Of course, you know, since the virus, the pandemic, we haven't been anywhere, and the ocean is my place of peace. And so I'm so excited about getting down there and being at the ocean and being on the beach and seeing, hearing, and I'm just so excited about that. So
we, yes, you.
Yeah,
it'll be interesting when you're at the beach. This is when your podcast will come live. So you'll be relaxing in la playa, taking in those waves, and we'll be here listening to your awesome story. So I'm excited for that, and it sounds so exciting.
It will be. I just, like I said, that I can go to the ocean, and it helps me get my peace. And so it's really important to me. It gives me strength. It gives me peace. And I'm so excited. Just really excited.
Yes. And how often do you go to Mexico? How often do you get out there without the pandemic, of course?
We went, the last time we went to Mexico, we went to Los Cabos. And we were there a little over a year ago because it was the last big trip that we took. And we went there and we were there for a week. And the time before that, so I like to go about once every year or so. The time before that, we went to Puerto Vallarta. And so I like going down there. I like the ocean and I like being in Mexico, you know?
So. Yeah. That's awesome. And I emailed you back when you shared that you were going to Cancun. I was like, that just sounds delicious. Okay. You know, it just gives you that strength that you mentioned. And I'm excited to see you come back. A ver qué pasa con Yolanda Nuncio when she's back.
Yeah, so ready.
Awesome. That's exciting news. So let's dive in a little bit then. If we can talk a little bit about your ethnic identity, your pronouns, if we can do that, we're trying to be very uplifting everybody within the podcast. We want to make sure that we acknowledge every individual and their identity. So if you can give us your pronouns and your ethnic identity, please. Okay.
My ethnic identity is I am a Chicana. My grandparents were all from Mexico. I had one from Chihuahua, one from Guanajuato, and two from Jalisco. So my roots are Mexican. I'm indigenous. We were always taught by my mother that we were indigenous and that we were as an American as any other person in this country, and never to forget that. And, you know, you think about that. And she was telling us that when we were young, so that was a long time ago that my family recognized that fact that we're mestizos, our roots are mestizos. And so I identify as a Chicana. I do not identify as a Mexican American or as an American of Mexican descent. The reasons for that being that I also take pride in being a Chicana, because to me that indicates that there's not only pride in who I am and what I am, but it also talks about, it refers to my social identity as far as politics, as far as equity, as far as justice. I think it all falls under the term Chicana. So that's me. As far as the pronouns, I like the pronouns she, hers, and I like to use comadre now. And she and hers are important to me because I think it's important that, you know, if we expect to receive respect and if we expect to be treated with equity, and we want to promote the whole Latino Chicano identity thing, then we need to be able to respect others for their own identities. And so those are the terms that I use. And then I also like comadre because that puts family in there. And for people who don't know what comadre means, comadre is the parent, is the godparent of one of your children or of your, from your wedding. And, you know, padrinos, we call them padrinos or madrinas or my nino or my nina, depending on your age and where you're from. And it's like family, but it's not necessarily family, but it puts you in with family. If you're somebody's comadre, you're special, you're family, and not necessarily by blood, but your family. So those are the pronouns and the word that I use.
And I love that. And all of that could possibly even take an hour, Yolanda, if we really want to delve into our identities and what you just shared, because the Chicano movement has such a rich history here in the United States, and the pride of just the word Chicano, it's so rich. So I would be interested to delve into a little bit more, but let me then also say comadre, that is new to me. I haven't heard the pronouns, you know, that piece of comadre coming in there. So it also gives me joy, because when you think of comadre, you feel family, you feel unity, you feel friendship, sisterhood. So I really, really love that piece. I just want to ask, first of all, Chicano spelled C-H-I-C-A-N-O or A at the end. And if you can just share, I know that maybe individuals know of the general United States Chicano movement, but would you be willing to talk a little bit about your own coming to terms with that word, Chicana, and how old were you when you came to terms with that identity?
I was 19 years old. You know, I was born and raised here in Grand Island. My father was from Nebraska. He was born in Nebraska. My mother was from Colorado. The families moved here in the 1920s through the 40s, and they came here because of my father's family worked in the sugar beets. My mother's family came to work. My grandpa came to work on the railroad, at the railroad. And that's where they met and, you know, married, and here we are. And so I grew up here. I went to Catholic school, was one of about six kids that were Latino at school. And so I grew up in a private school, private Catholic school, with a lot of kids that came from affluent families or doctors' families and lawyers' families. You know, I grew up down on the east side, the other side of the tracks, and we had our income. My father worked, my mother worked. There were four of us, and if we were poor, we didn't know it. You know, because we always had beans and we always had tortillas and we always had rice and potatoes. And we all have diabetes now, but we had all those food, you know? And I remember my dad saying that we would never go hungry as long as we had rice, or as long as we had potatoes and beans and tortillas, we would never go hungry. And so we had a good life. When I was 19 years old, I went to live in Oregon. I was a VISTA volunteer. And I worked with a Chicano organization in Woodburn, Oregon. I lived in Oregon for 3 years, and that's when I became involved with the whole Chicano movement. I was fortunate enough to meet Cesar Chavez, We had the Poor People's Campaign in Oregon, and I think it may have even started out there, but there was the Poor People's Campaign, and we also did some demonstrations at a federal camp that had, it was a military camp, it was Camp Adair, and had been closed down, and we wanted that facility for our people in the Poor People's Campaign to be able to live there, because homelessness and poverty and hunger and all those issues that we're still fighting were really prevalent at that time. And so we did demonstrating with Cesar Chavez and with United Farm Workers. And, you know, I'll never forget that, because he was such an important man in our history. And then also was involved with the Brown Berets. And because they had chapters up in Oregon at that time. And so we got the Cesar Chavez side with United Farm Workers, and we got the Brown Berets side with the people in that community. So that's where I grew up. That's where I became involved. That's where I first started identifying as a Chicana. And then I came home. And when we came back, then I went to work with a community action program. And there was people in my life at that time that were very, very important to me. They were my mentors, my models. Miriam Ramirez was my boss, and she was my mom and dad's comadre too, but she was an activist at that time, and she trained me and taught me so much. And you know, her family, the Ramirez family still lives here, but Miriam's passed, but her children still live in different parts of the country, and we still maintain contact with them. Anyway, so then I went to work with Community Action, and we were organizing. I mean, I was 23 years old at the time, and we were organizing within our community. And I'll never forget that we were involved with, under Miriam's leadership and Miriam's persistence, we have the school lunch programs and the breakfast program here in Grand Island at the public schools. And that program actually started as a part of the committee, the group that we were working with back in the 70s. And wow. I remember going to, again, I was just a young kid, and they were all older adults, mature adults. And we went to school board meetings, and we went, we demonstrated, we did all this, finally got the school lunch program there. So we helped establish it here, never knowing that, you know, 40 years later, we were going to still have a school lunch program in addition to breakfast programs. So, you know, those things happened way back then. We also did lots of things as a community. We were able to bring in Corky Gonzalez from Denver and the Crusade for Justice. We had ballets and we had shows. And I remember when we brought in Corky Gonzalez, there was a lot of discussion in town about that big Chicano, militant Chicano from Denver was coming in, and he was bringing people. Well, the people he was bringing were all dancers in the group, because they had this ballet folklorico, and so it caused quite a little stir in the community. But I remember that being almost the first time that we had Mexican ballet perform here in Grand Island, and it was at the high school, and we had a good attendance. And so that's really the beginning. After that, then I went to work with La Raza Cultural Center. And again, 40 years ago, you know, we worked with La Raza Cultural Center, and I directed a folkloric dance group, and we took those kids all over the place. And kids still call me and say, well, they're not kids anymore, and they want pictures from those days, you know. But we went to the penitentiary, and we went to the university, and we were on TV, and we did all these things. And the kids still remember, still talk about it, you know. So we did that. And we also did one of the very first sensitivity awareness training here in Grand Island for Grand Island Public Schools. Dr. Marty Ramirez came and was one of the presenters, and all of the school system had to be there. It was compulsory training. And we received the support of the superintendent of the schools at the time. So this all goes back a long ways. You know, we've been doing these things for a long, long time. And the interesting part is that we had the population that was here. We had a lot of Latinos, but we were all Mexican. our roots were all Mexican at that time, you know, so it's shifted now so much into include other Latinos, other subgroups within the Latino communities. But at that time, it was all Mexican. We were all Mexican or Chicanos. And the other funny part of that is that so many of us, because we were all old families, were related. So if you were Ramirez, you could be related to the Martinez, and then you were related to the Aguilars, and, you know, just it was all family. It was all grown. And our history also goes back to the early 1900s. And people forget about that lots of times. But I remember one time talking with Mrs. Nalgosa, and she's a lady that she was a pillar in this community. And I thought that she was from Texas or Mexico. She was born right here in Grand Island, I think she told me. And I think it was 1913. And so our history goes back a long ways. It isn't just from the 70s. We go back a long ways. And we have some of the, like the Nalgosa family, there's like 4 and 5 generations now of Nalgosa family members here in Grand Island. Our history is long. People don't recognize that.
No. And what there's so much. I just want to keep going. You know, like I want to, at first I want to pay homage to Miriam. Ramirez, right? Mm-hmm. And just being able to say she was a mentor to you. You are a mentor to me. And obviously that's still continuing. But in addition to you doing sensitivity training, you know, how many years back? And to this day, we still need sensitivity training in a lot of our school systems. And then just being able to recognize that, yeah, our stories aren't being told. We don't know about this because we don't know about it, right? Nothing is being written about it. There's no documentary saying, hey, this is how long we've been in the state. And, you know, our indigenous roots have been here longer, you know, so where does that lie? And how come we at times get depicted as these insurgents or individuals that are coming to attack this conservative world of the state of Nebraska? It's very interesting to hear, but I think that's one of the reasons why we want to do this podcast. That's why we want to lift up these stories, because we want to make sure that we put that mark in that history and be able to share. Yolanda Nuncio, as a young girl trying to make it, you know, Oregon came back and you've done so much, and you've only given us a taste of all of the movements that you've done, which includes the meals that in schools. So I'm excited to just continue to have this conversation, but I just, one of the questions that I want to ask you, you have seen these years of movement. Have we progressed? Where are we now? Do you think we have come a long way? And then what's next?
I think we've come a long ways because we have moved forward. I don't think that we are where we need to be. I don't think that we're in a position yet where we are truly accepted in this community, you know, as I think it's the same situation across the state. I think that when I graduated from high school, there were 6 Latinos that graduated. And I respectfully say Latinos because not all of the 6 of us consider themselves Chicanos. But there were 6 of us that graduated. When I started school, we had a much larger number of kids that were Latinos that were in the school system at that point. Somewhere along the line, we continued to lose kids, so that in my class, there were 6 of us that graduated, and that was it. Some of us finally did go on to college, and some of us didn't. Most of us were all very successful, you know, when you define success, depending on how you define success. And so I think that we have come a long ways. You know, we now have a minority population here in Grand Island. Over 50% of the kids at the high school are children of color, including Latino kids, close to 50%, and it might even be more than 50% this year. But we also have children from African sub-Saharan backgrounds and cultures, as well as children, Asian American children, and Native American indigenous children. And so the majority of the population at the high school is minority majority. And that is pretty important. I think that the thing that is really truly impressing me right now is how well some of our kids are doing. I mean, 10 years ago, you wouldn't have seen number of kids that we see now that are involved in school. We have a lot of children, Latino kids, who are in National Honor Society. We have cheerleaders, something as simple as cheerleaders. We have a good representation of young people of color and of Latino young women on the cheerleading squad. That never happened until these last few years. We have a Chicana dentist. We have a Latino pharmacist. We have bankers and branch managers and vice president in the banking field. And, you know, Juan Cangas is an example. He's a young man from Grand Island. He's now in Omaha working with programs with the Omaha Public Schools. And he's also a nationally recognized speaker with Cool Speak. Melissa Guerrero Schultz is a dentist here in Grand Island. Her family is an old family in Grand Island. She might even be third or fourth generation. So Mirta Delgado is the vice president of banking at Five Points Bank. And she's the branch manager there and is doing a great job as well. Jessica Campos is another young lady who is the director of the Women's Center with REAP, for the Center for Rural Affairs. And so we have exceptional people, and I'm so proud of all these young people because they're doing so, so well. But I believe that there are still issues within the school district in Grand Island. One example, and Dr. Grover, our superintendent of schools, is aware of my feelings on this because I have mentioned it to her. But one of the concerns that I have is that the number of kids that are in the Ombudsman program, which is an alternative education program for the high school here, many of those kids are students of color. Most of those kids are Latino. And there's a breakdown there, you know, and it is concerning to me. So we are not where we need to be. We have made considerable progress. Our children are doing well, are doing better, but not all of our children are doing better.
Yeah, so. I agree. You know, it's so beautiful to be able to see our younger generations going out to the world and making such an impact. But a la misma vez, there's still time. There's still space for so much improvement, acknowledging maybe some systemic racism structures that are happening within our school systems and being able to talk about those and figuring out solutions for it. Let's talk a little bit about your career, because that impact can be different for everybody. So everybody, I know I have delved into domestic violence survivor advocate, child protective services advocate, you know, to college career counseling. So can you talk to us a little bit about your professional career and how it has impacted you being a Latina in that professional role?
Okay. Yes, I'm very proud of my career. I was a teacher. In fact, I still consider myself an educator, but I was a teacher. I taught ESL. And so I had the opportunity to literally teach children from all over the world. You know, I had the kids from Mexico and from Central America and students from South America, but I had students from Vietnam and from Taiwan and from Russia and literally from all over the world. And so I taught for many years here in Grand Island at different schools. The majority of my career was at Walnut Middle School. And we had some outstanding students there. In fact, several of the students that I mentioned were students of mine at Walnut Middle School. So I taught for many, many years. And then I finished my master's degree and in administration and school administration, in administration and supervision. And I accepted a position as a principal of Morton Elementary School in Lexington. And I was there for a few years and had a school of close to 400 students at that time. And we had about 383, I think. And if I remember correctly, 13 of those kids were Anglo children. The rest of the students were either Latino, mostly Latino, but there were a couple of Indigenous children and a couple of African-American children as well. I can remember when I went into Morton and the kids were surprised because I was their new principal. And I can remember one day walking, and I remember the boys' names too, but I walked into the lunchroom because I had lunchroom duty that day, had only been there a few weeks. And I remember that one of the little boys in kindergarten called me over. So I went over to talk to him and he said, "Are you a Mexican?" And I said, "Yes, I'm a Mexican." And he said, "And your name is Mrs. Nuncio?" And I said, "Yeah, my name's Mrs. Nuncio." And he turned to the other little boys and he goes, "Look," he goes, "she's a Mexican just like us, you know." And then he turned around and he goes, "Do you speak Spanish?" And I said, "Yes, I speak Spanish." And he said, "So does that mean we can speak Spanish in school now?" And I said, "Well, you can speak Spanish anywhere, anytime you want to." I said, but yeah, I said, and you'll be bilingual and you'll speak Spanish and English. And, "Oh, okay." And, you know, I'll never forget that little boy telling me that, you know, "Are you Mexican just like me?" And so, you know, I absolutely loved being at Morton. I love the students that I have. I still have contact with a lot of those students. And so that was my education career. That was the majority of my career. After I retired from education, because I came back to Grand Island, and I didn't move to Lexington because it just wasn't right for my family at that time. And so when I came back to Grand Island, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. I was sure that I wasn't going to apply for any positions at that time. And then somebody called me and said, "You ought to apply for a position with HHS." And I said, you know, and they said, "Well, the position is for an area administrator. So you ought to apply for it." "No, I don't know." Well, I ended up applying for it and I ended up getting hired for this position. And in that position, I was responsible for over 300 employees and over a $10 million budget. And I was the administrator for Child Protective Services and for Economic Assistance and Disability Services. I mean, it was all of it. It was absolutely huge. And that's probably the most challenging part of my career ever, because of the size of it and because of the issues. You know, I had never expected to ever have to work with child abuse and Child Protective Services. And that was really hard because all of those cases were a part of the programs. You know, we had a couple of children's deaths when I was with the department. And those are always hard, especially for our the families, but also for the staff, because they've been working with families. And so I was responsible for the area from Kearney through Grand Island and then up through O'Neill and then down through Hastings and south of Hastings. So it was a huge, huge area. My challenges were more with changing the system. Because, you know, we were expecting people to be working with non-English speaking families and families that have different cultures, different traditions, and live differently than maybe some families and people expect families in this country to live. So there were a lot of challenges, and there weren't a lot of people that were bilingual, bicultural. A lot of times people think that in order to work well in these positions, you have to be bilingual. Yeah, bilingualism is a very, very important skill that you have to have in working with families in this field, but you also have to be bicultural, because if you don't understand the differences in cultures, then you may overlook something or you may see something that really isn't there. So that was very, very challenging work. And I did leave there. There were, you know, and politically, I was pretty involved with a lot of movements at that time, and the immigration rallies and stuff were just starting to take place. And so it was really a challenge for me as Yolanda Nuncio because of the things that I believed in. And so I left the state and was glad to be gone. You know, it was hard work. It was work that was very, very challenging. And it was good to be gone when I left. So then I was able to, I go to church at St. Mary's. And one of the things that I've always been interested in is immigration and citizenship. When I was at Walnut, because so many of my students were students from other countries, I had many, many parents who maybe were interested in becoming citizens. And so I taught citizenship classes to the parents of my students for many years. So if you think about it, 30 years ago, I was teaching citizenship classes, and today, we're up until the pandemic, I've still been teaching citizenship classes. And so I've had an interest in immigration, and so I was able to work part-time with the immigration program at St. Mary's. I was accredited. I became a BIA accredited rep and worked with helping people with their immigration papers. So I did that for a while, and then I ended up working for, I worked for two nonprofits during that time, and then I went to work for a private attorney, which was way different than working for right. a nonprofit. And so that's pretty much where I ended up with my career. I did work at UNK for about 6 years, part-time as like an advisor to Peter Kiewit Scholars. And what I did there is I would meet with these students monthly and make sure that they were on track to keep their scholarships, because these students were really exceptional students and were going to be teachers. And they received the Peter Kiewit Scholarship, which enabled them to go to college, go to the university. And if they maintained their grades and met all the guidelines, they would get almost $40,000 worth of their education paid for. So they were exceptional scholarships, exceptional kids, and all of those kids have graduated, or most of them graduated. And so then I was done about a year ago now. And so that's my professional career.
In regards to your career, I think I would love to delve one of these days into how Latinas in professional settings, you know, how we survive, how we can move forward in that. And I think that's worthy of a future conversation. But if we can talk a little bit about now, you know, where are you now? What are you up to? I don't believe you're fully retired. You're still very much staying up at night, doing a lot of good work, you know, and do you want to talk a little bit about what you're currently doing?
Currently, I'm a part of, with you, on the Solidarity with Meatpacking Plant Workers. We've been meeting for a year now, pushing for the safety and protection of the meatpacking plant workers in Nebraska. The virus has had a horrible effect upon our community, and we know that in many of the communities, it's because of the fact that the packing plants may not always be meeting the needs of their workers in providing them sufficient protection and safety to keep them safe and to keep them from help them prevent getting the pandemic, getting the virus. And then once they're getting it, taking it out into their families, into their homes, mm-hmm. into their communities. We both know that the virus has had we've lost many, many people to the virus from our communities. And so we've put in a lot of work over the last year to help protect our communities. Right now, I would actually like to urge people to contact their state senators and urge them to vote in support of LB 241, which is a bill that was introduced by Senator Vargas out of Omaha to require protection and distancing and sick leave for packing plant workers. It's going to go before the state legislature any day now before this session ends, and we need the support of our senators provide that safety and that protection to the employees in those packing plants. We know that the work is hard work, and it's work that it's honest work, and the people that our meatpacking plant workers deserve to be treated with respect and with dignity and receive the same protections that anybody else that works, that lives here, is entitled to receive. So, you know, I'm going to use this to ask people to please contact their senators in support of this bill. So that's one of the things I'm doing and that I've been involved with. We also are still involved with immigration. I hope to be able to start up a class again in the next few weeks for citizenship, and because I get a lot of calls from a lot of people that want to become citizens. They're ready now, and the process of becoming a citizen is a very long process. I spoke to a young woman who submitted her application a year ago this month. It was April 9th was the day she submitted her application, and she just got her notice to go for her biometrics last week. So it took it took that long to get to this point for her to become a citizen. And you know, part of the reasoning for that, I believe, in reading and different conference calls, stuff that I participate in nationally. Part of the reason for that is because so much money has been taken from USCIS and has been put into enforcement. So it has therefore impacted not only naturalization, but also DACA and TPS and all the different programs that people, the benefits that people are able to apply for have been put on the back burner, you know, while all the focus the last 4 years has been on the enforcement side of it. So they're really far behind, and the waiting periods are ridiculous. And so our congressmen need to know that they need to provide, there needs to be funding for this part of immigration, on the education side of it, and help people become citizens, because it's really unnecessary for people to have to wait so long. You know, if you want to become a citizen, you're willing to do the work, to study, to do the application, to pay the money and submit your application, then there's nothing you should expect to have this done in a reasonable amount of time. So those are some of the things there. We've also been, I've also had the opportunity to go to the border. Again, haven't been able to do that in over a year now, again, because of the pandemic, but I've been to the border at Tucson 3 times. I've been to the border in El Paso, and I've been also to Laredo. And with all 3 different cities, it's been a different experience. In Laredo, I was able to go as a part of a legal team. I'm not an attorney, but I was able to go as part of a legal team to help them interpret for people who were seeking asylum. And we worked with the detention center. And the first 3 times that I went down, we were able to go into the detention center and work with and interview women who were seeking asylum, who were being held in detention, who had just gotten out of La Hielera and were now waiting for a chance to see a judge to start the immigration process, the asylum process. The last time we went, because of the Remain in Mexico program that the former president initiated, the people were not able to even come across. So the interviews that we did with the women, with the people, were being done via telephone. We were in Laredo, if they were on the other side, and they were conducting those interviews on a telephone. And that was much more difficult, but that was the extent of the work that we did in Laredo. In Tucson, I was able to work with a center that received asylees. And what would happen with those folks is that they would be under ICE, and ICE would release them to the center where we worked, and the name of the center was Casa Elitas. They would release them to the center. And then once they came to the center, we would work with them and their families to get them to someplace in the United States while they waited for the asylum process to go through. It was some of the most rewarding work that I've ever done, because we were there a little over a week, and every day ICE would call and say, we're sending over a bus. There are 40, 50 people on the bus. And when they'd get the call, they'd say, ICE is sending a bus, and they'd announce it throughout the plant, throughout the center. And there's everybody get ready. So then when the bus would come along, it was a big white immigration, old bus. And it came around and it drove through the driveway, turned around and parked in front of the door. And when they pulled up, people that were volunteers there opened the doors, and we all went and stood outside. And as these families start to get off the bus, you know, they're scared. They're carrying their backpacks. They're getting off the bus, kind of looking around. And the ICE officials are unlocking the bus to get other things out. And everybody goes, bienvenidos a los Estados Unidos, welcome to the United States, or bienvenidos a America, or whatever, you know. And they'd start crying, and we'd start crying, and the kids would start, and it was very, very powerful. So anyway, once they went through the process there and were feeling a little more welcome, then they would come into the center office and they would call their families. And so we had phones, or they had phones there, and we'd call the number, and they would speak to whomever they were calling, who was going to be their sponsor. And then we would talk to them and make arrangements for them to leave the center to go to San Francisco or to Rhode Island or wherever they were going. And there was this one gentleman that, yes, he was sitting down next to me, and we were calling and making his arrangements for him to leave. And he's talking to his father, and he goes, you know, he tells his dad, you know, in Spanish, aquí estoy, ya llego. And dad said something, he goes, no, aquí estoy en Tucson, Arizona. And the dad said something, he goes, no, he says, estamos bien, estamos bien. And he had his two small children with him, and he goes, estamos bien. And the father asked him something. He goes, no, papá. He says, nos tratan bien. He said, nos están dando comida y podemos bañar. Tenemos cama y nos están tratando como familia. Mm-hmm. And then the father said something. And then he turned to me and he asked me, he said, are you a part of the government? We said, no, we're not. And he goes, no, papá, no son del gobierno. Estamos bien y ya vamos a salir. You know, so those kinds of stories, and that's what's happening in the centers. All of that had stopped because of the Remain in Mexico program, but they're coming now. The people are coming across again. And so people are coming, and the centers in all of these communities are again working with families, trying to help them have something happen to their lives. So that's where I've been.
If people don't know why I look up to you, I hope they now see why I look up to you and why, you know, I center my work around your work, because I know that you're nonstop. You will continue to advocate in whatever way you can advocate on behalf of our community. And I have always been appreciative of that. So again, Yolanda Nuncio in the flesh, completely happy to have you in the podcast, and just excited to be able to share a little bit about you to the world that listens to Courageous Mujer. Let's continue then. I want to touch this piece. I have two more questions for you. Una, you are a mom, you're a grandma, and you're changing the world. How does that work for you? I know I'm a mom, you know, and it's interesting, you know, trying to balance, because you always want to balance. We want to have enough time for your kiddos. You want to have enough time to change the world. How do you do it? Can we do it all? You know, and how do you balance it?
It takes a lot of work, you know, and especially now it's different for me because my kids are grown up, and I have three grandkids here in Grand Island, and I have two grandkids in Lincoln, and just About 2 weeks ago, all five of my grandkids were here at our house together for the first time since before the pandemic. And so it's been over a year since they were here together. And then they all came home again on Easter, on Saturday, and we were all here together on Saturday. My daughter wasn't able to come because of some family stuff in Omaha, but and we were a busy little place here, and you know, it takes getting used to again, because they've not all been here together. So, you know, it is hard to do, but you have to have your priorities. For example, today is my one of my granddaughter's 13th birthday. And tonight I have two meetings, and I know we're going to have dinner or something for Alicia. And so you just do it. You have to make time for your family, you know, the same way that you have to make time for yourself, because none of it can be healthy if all of it isn't good. And so you have to pace yourself. You have to learn to pace yourself. You guys that are still young, that have young children, have to remember that, because your children, your families, your husbands. You know, I have a very good husband. He has always supported me. But when Saul married me, he already knew what I was. You know, I wasn't a surprise for him anymore, you know. So he knew what I was like and what I was involved with when we got married. So I've always been very blessed with that, because he's always been very supportive. And the kids, where they grew up, also, you know, we taught them community service, and they would go with us to do different things in the community, to help out in different projects and that. And but you have to be able to do that, especially when you have the younger children, because they have to know they come first. And I don't think my children ever doubted that they didn't come first. I think they knew it. So
it's beautiful. It is hard. Trying to balance it. I think for me, when I was working full time and being in front of the computer, you know, that was very overwhelming to then be able to take care of the kiddos and pandemic centric, you know, because we were homeschooling our kids. So it is very interesting how all of your families are currently trying to help and change the world, pero la misma vez prioritizing our kiddos and making sure that they feel loved, that they know that they're number one. You know, our partners, like you said, Chris has been very much supportive of my work. He knew right away, you know, like Gladys is not just anybody else. Maybe much like Saul thought of you. And I remember seeing him. I always see him in the background when we're on video chats, just making sure and checking in on you. So I love that. Porque siempre está ahí por ahí, you know, I know you're listening.
And I don't know if you saw him or not, but he just walked through a little bit ago. And so that's just part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wonderful. That's beautiful. Well, this is called Courageous Mujer Podcast. And we have heard, you know, beautiful stories about what you have done. Let's talk a little bit, maybe just touch one story in which you have felt fear, but you still felt the necessity of doing an act. And all of the things that you have done have, you know, you had to be courageous to do all of them. But if you would be willing to share maybe one story in regards to courage, you know, where you sensed that fear before you did it, then you did it anyways, because you knew it needed to be done.
I have different stories, but I think I'm going to talk about when I left Head Start. I worked at Head Start for 13 years, and I started out, I had just gotten married. We'd been married like 2 weeks, and Miriam Ramirez needed a bus driver and a teacher's aide. And I wasn't working. I had been working for a migrant program, and the funding ended, so I was a newlywed with no job. And so Miriam called me and asked me if I would be able to help her out as a bus driver and a classroom aide. So, you know, why not? I'm not doing anything. So I did. And so I went to work for Head Start And as I'm working for Head Start over the years, I ended up with Head Start for 13 years. And I started as a bus driver classroom aide, went up to a teacher and taking classes and, you know, going to school and whatever. And I ended up being a coordinator for career development for all the staff and the education coordinator. So we did a lot of planning, a lot of staff development, and that was all under me. And I decided that I needed to go back to school to finish my degree because I'd been taking all these classes and I thought, man, it's not going to take me very long. I'll quit my job or I'll go to school part-time and finish my degree. So that's what the plan was. And so I went to UNK to talk to my advisor to see what I needed to do to and how long it was going to take me, thinking it was going to be a few months, you know, to finish my degree. And he looked over my file and over all my classes. He said, it's going to take you 2 years. And I, two and a half years. And I said, but I have all these classes, you know, I have all these credits. I mean, I had like 100 hours in credits. And he goes, yeah, he goes, you have all these credits, but they're not in your program. You know, you want to be a teacher, you're going to be early childhood. These classes aren't part of your program. And I mean, I sat there and I was absolutely defeated. I thought, I don't know how, you know, I can't do this. I have three small children at home. I have my job. I can't leave my job to go to school full time. So, and then, excuse me, for this long, and I could do it for a few months, but not for this long. And I sat there and I was really close to crying. And he goes, but that's okay. He says, you can do this. You know, it's going to take you a little longer. He says, but you can figure out a way to do this and whatever. So I, you know, thanked him and whatever. And I left and I was so defeated. I thought, I'm not going to be able to do this. But I sat in the car and cried. I thought, I don't know. I can't do this. So you can't drive home because I'm in Kearney. I live in Grand Island. So I drove over to Target and I just walked around Target for a really long time and finally got myself together and I drove home. And on the, during that time, I thought, you can do this. You know, it's scary and it's going to be hard, but you can do this. And so I went home and talked with Saul and we got it all worked out. I quit my job. I went on, took a leave of absence for the first semester. And then I resigned and finished out that year. And the following year, I got my bachelor's degree. And that was one of the hardest things for me because when I was in high school, my counselor, and this was still hard to talk about, did not encourage me to go to college. I wanted to be a teacher and I wanted to be a nurse. I thought I wanted to be a nurse. And so I went in and I said, okay, I want to be a nurse. And so what do I need to do? And she goes, I really don't think you can be a nurse. And I said, why not? You know, I'll just go to school. And she said, because to be a nurse, you have to be really, really good in science. And in math, she goes, you don't like math and you're not good at science. So I don't think you can be a nurse. And I said, okay. All right. So then I thought about it and I thought, no, I really, really, really want to be a teacher. So I went back to her and said, okay, I've decided that this is what I really want to do. I really want to be a teacher. And she said, well, I don't think you can be a teacher either because you still have to be very good at science and you have to be very good at math. And, you know, she'd already told me that. I said, well, I got to do something. What should I do? Yeah. And she said, go to beauty school and be a hairdresser. And I said, well, I'm going to like that. And she goes, no, you go to school, you get your education, you can be a hairdresser. So I had to do something, right? My parents are saying go to school. She's saying go to beauty school, whatever. And so I went to beauty school and I was terrible. I mean, I graduated, I got my license and everything, but I was terrible and I hated it. I hated coloring, I hated perms, I hated cuts, I hated everything. And you know, when you hate something, you're not good at it either.
Right.
And so, I mean, I hated it. And So I ended up leaving that. And then I did the whole VISTA thing. I went to work with Community Action. I did the VISTA thing. And then I came back a different person, went back, finished my degree. And when I got that degree, I went to her and I said, see, I am smart enough to do this. And so then when I got my master's, I was going to go do that again, but she died. So I didn't get to. But, you know, I think that, and I don't know where I was headed with this now, but I think that's part of the reason quitting my job and going back to school was so hard, because those memories are still there. Yeah. And you don't forget those things. And so you may not always have the people that you need to have building you up and pushing you forward. And so sometimes things are really hard to do. So. Mm-hmm.
And you did it though, you know, you got your bachelor's, you got your master's. I mean, what didn't you become? And you're still doing it. It's incredible how we, you know, get into a mindset because of the people that are in our lives. I know with Rose's podcast, we talked a little bit about that, and she wanted to be an FBI agent. Mm-hmm. And then here you are wanting to be a teacher, and it just having that person, that advisor. And even that advisor that was at UNK and told you, yes, you can, it's going to take some work, but you can still do it. And then you acknowledging and understanding that you have the power to do it. Yeah. That's beautiful, Yolanda. You didn't give up. Nope. And it was scary as heck.
Yep. So
that's awesome.
I think that's what I think people, young women especially, because, you know, I get really surprised when I know families who there's maybe three or four kids, the boys have been encouraged to go to school, go to college. They come out and they've got that four-year degree or whatever it is. And the girls aren't encouraged in the same way. I don't think we even realize that we do that to ourselves and to our kids. And so I think young women need to realize that there are people out here that will do everything that we can to support them and to help them reach their dreams, to have those dreams and to reach those dreams and to be those models for them. Because you can do it. If you have to believe in yourself, but you can do it. And as young women, they need to believe that. And they need to take advantage of the support that's out there for them, because too often we've been taught to know you don't want to, you know, get help, or you don't want to do this, you don't want to do that. You take advantage of the opportunities that are out there.
Yeah. My next question, and it's the end, you know, the end question is, what would you say to these young women, either be it, you know, high school, middle school, college, still in college, or just women like me, you know, what is your advice or big takeaway in regards to how we can be here in the state of Nebraska? How do we make an impact? What would your advice be to little Yolandas in the world?
I would tell young women, and I do tell young women, to, first of all, once you know what you want to be, and you're not always going to know right away, you know, because you might think, many, many kids will go to college thinking, oh, I'm going to be a teacher. And once they get started, they know they don't want to be a teacher. Maybe they want to be a social worker, or they want to be a counselor or whatever, you know. But so there's nothing wrong with changing your mind. If you think that this is what you want to do, then go for it and try it and start off by going to school and start. You got to start somewhere. And then you may find that that's not exactly what you want. Then don't be afraid to change your mind and to pursue what it is that you want to do. And you have to have those dreams. And then you have to be prepared to work hard to get them and to achieve what you want to achieve with yourself. Take advantage of the opportunities that are there for you and of the people that are there to help you, because we know people who will do everything they can to help get kids where they want to be. And so take advantage of those. Take advantage of the scholarships. Don't be afraid to apply for a scholarship and, you know, knowing that, well, I might not get it, but you don't get it if you don't try. So you have to take advantage of the opportunities that are there. Take advantage of being a young woman of color, You know, there's opportunities there for you, whether if you're just, if you're Latina or if you're just a young woman of color, whatever your situation may be, take advantage of that situation. If it's something that you feel is even kind of negative, flip it, make it a positive, use it to your advantage so that you can get what you really want to do. And the other thing is, don't forget where you came from. And if you go and you get those degrees or you get where you want to be, take somebody else with you so that another young woman can also do the same thing. So those would
that's
be my,
beautiful.
And don't be afraid to contact us, because we'll help. You know, I'm writing letters right now for a young woman who's working on some things and she needs a reference letter. And so when I get done with this, I'm going to finish that up right now. So take advantage of people that are there to help you.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit then about how to contact you. So, ¿a dónde llegan? How do they contact Yolanda Nuncio? Do we reach out to you via email? Do we reach out to you Facebook? What's the best way to get a hold of you?
The best way to get a hold of me is through either email or Facebook. You know, also my phone, but the best way probably either Facebook or email, because I use those all the time.
And okay, so we'll make sure. We'll make sure to put it on the description so then people are aware of how to contact you. It is an honor to have you here. We didn't talk about our meeting story, but we crossed paths in college, in my professional career. I was in Child Protective Services when you were that district manager over the Department of Health and Human Services. And now I left, but I came back. You were in my graduation reception. For my bachelor's degree that did take 6 years to obtain, but I still did it. So you have impacted me. You have impacted a lot of women that I know, a lot of men and women that we know throughout the state of Nebraska. And one of the biggest things that I've gotten from you is that unconditional love. And I am always grateful for you, Yolanda, because I know you, it's not just me that you give, you know, that unconditional love to. I think it's to everybody. You've given that love to everybody within our communities. So forever, forever grateful. And I hope to bring you back, you know, because we have talked about so much. It's about family, career, Latinas within the, you know, workforce. So just, I hope that you come back and we can have further conversations about all of these issues that impact us and then how we can overcome them. Any parting words, any last words before we go?
I like watching your podcasts. I really enjoy the one with your mom because I know your mom and she's such a good woman. And I enjoyed the one with Rosangela because you guys laugh and you have fun. And as I've told you, I always laugh when I'm with you two, with both of you. You just lighten up things. And so I enjoyed that one as well. And the other ones that I've seen, but thank you for having me here. I enjoy this. I think you're doing a really good job with these podcasts. And I think it's very important in our community that you're doing this. And so I wish you continued success with them. And I'll come back anytime you want me to. So.
Yes, we will definitely have more conversations with Yolanda Nuncio and being able to just tap into your brain a little bit in regards to a lot of issues that are happening within our community. And Rose and I are always happy to go eat some cheesecake with you and have a good time. So, otra vez, gracias, Yolanda Nuncio. I love you from the bottom of my heart. Y hasta la próxima.
Thank you. I love you guys too. Thank you.
Courageous Mujer Podcast is brought to you by United by Culture in Lexington, Nebraska. United by Culture celebrates our differences and lives by the saying, many nations, one family. Feel free to follow United by Culture on Instagram and Facebook. Again, you can find Courageous Mujer Podcast at Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Anchor. Feel free to catch the full episode on YouTube. While you're there, do not forget to like, subscribe, and comment. I'm your host, Gladys Godinez, y hasta la próxima.